Hello and welcome to Season 2 of the Blue Economy Podcast, presented by Rhode Island, the Ocean State. I'm your host, David Hirschman, and on today's episode, we're talking about building a virtual ocean with Judson Kaufman, co-founder of ocean data collection company TerraDepth. Based in Austin, Texas, TerraDepth is using autonomous hybrid vehicles, basically robot submarines, to collect ocean floor data from around the world. It's still early days for TerraDepth, but their ultimate goal is to collect enough data to build what they're calling the Google Earth of the ocean. Thanks to Judson and TerraDepth for the conversation, and thank you for tuning in today. As always, we hope you'll subscribe, rate, and review our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you're listening. And you can learn more about the show at www.blueeconomypodcast.com or by following us on Twitter, Facebook, or LinkedIn. And now, here's our interview with Judson Kaufman, the co-founder and co-CEO of TerraDepth. Great to meet you, Judson. Let's maybe just start with the basics. You know, according to your website, TerraDepth is a data-as-a-service company with the mission of increasing ocean knowledge through autonomous, high-resolution, and scalable data collection. Can you tell me a little bit about what that all means, and I guess what does the company do, and how long have you been around?
Yeah, thanks, David, and thanks for having me on. I'm excited to be here and love talking about what we're up to, so happy to share what I can. Basically, humanity knows very little, shockingly little, about the ocean, and so we're trying to solve that. We want to create something similar to the network of satellites that are constantly orbiting Earth, collecting atmospheric data, terrestrial data of the planet. Nothing like that exists in the ocean. So there is no scaled ocean data collection that exists today. So that's really what TerraDepth is trying to do. And we want to not only collect that data on a global scale, but more importantly, we want to put that data into an application, a software, a cloud-based experience so that users can interact with that data and connect with the ocean in a way that they can't today and never have been able to before. We were started in the fall of 2018. So we're about 3 years old, close to 3 years old. And to date, we have developed and tested our first prototype. We're really excited about what we've accomplished to date, but we have a lot of work ahead of us.
Well, you and your co-CEO, Joe Welpel, are both Navy SEAL veterans. How did your military backgrounds lead to the creation of TerraDepth and, I guess, your current leadership roles within the company?
Yeah. So Joe and I met in the Navy, and I think the obvious sort of first answer there is that the Navy gave us an opportunity to connect with and fall in love with the ocean. And it also introduced us to the fact that humanity is so ignorant when it comes to what's happening in the ocean. For example, there was a nuclear-powered submarine that ran into a seamount in 2005. And the primary reason that it ran into the seamount is because they didn't know that it was there because they had bad maps or no maps, maps with very little data on them. So when we heard that back in 2005, that was kind of the first time that we understood there was this level of ignorance with respect to the ocean. Beyond that, sort of falling in love with the ocean and then learning, how much work there is yet to be done with ocean exploration, that experience gave us a lot of confidence in ourselves. It taught us some very discrete skills with respect to building teams, how to lead teams, how to organize, how to plan, how to have, short-term strategy, long-term strategy, the importance of establishing a mission and a vision and very basic values so that everyone is singing out the same sheet of music and marching in the same direction. So I think that's a short answer. I can elaborate for days on how the military experience kind of prepared us to do what we're doing now. But I think those are kind of the highlights there.
Cool. Something you said before, you often hear it said that we know more about the surface of the moon than we know about the ocean floor. And as recently as 2017, only about 6% of the ocean's floor had been mapped. I think in 2020, that number went up to about 20% of the ocean's floor had been mapped. And now researchers are hoping to have the entire ocean floor mapped by 2030. Why do you think there's been, why is there such a focus on this kind of knowledge lately? And I guess, why is there such a lack of data of what's going on in the ocean?
Yeah, So I'll kind of try to answer those in reverse. The last question was, you know, why haven't we done it before? And the reason is we haven't had the technology to enable this level of exploration. So for a long time, we've had submersibles that are capable of going to the deepest parts of the ocean, and we could put whatever sensors we want on them and collect whatever data we want. So we've been able to do that, but it's been so expensive that no one's had the money to afford to do that on scale. And so what we've seen is these really small scale missions for very specific interest items, like going to the Titanic or going to Mariana's Trench because it's like the Everest of the ocean. But there's been nothing done on scale because it's been so damn expensive. But in the last 10 years, with advancements in autonomous systems, specifically autonomous systems that are enabled by machine learning and artificial intelligence, plus the developments in just robotics, microchips, and processors, and the advancements in machine learning. So these really haven't gotten to a level of sophistication until probably the last 10 years, maybe even less than that, to enable some sort of an ocean-going robot to go and collect data, like comprehensive high-resolution data, really, really deep and also shallow, on a large scale. So part of the reason is just we haven't been able to do it. And that's one of the things that sort of drove Joe and I and the other members of TerraDepth to kind of jump on this quickly, because we saw what was happening with space. We saw what was happening with driverless cars. And we said, hey, someone's going to figure out that the ocean has a lot of value that can be captured by figuring out how to crack this nut with autonomy and robotics in the ocean space. So let's be the first ones to really do it. Remind me the other parts of that question.
No. I guess maybe my follow on is that like what kind of data are you collecting here? I mean, is it all like sort of temperature and like, or is it down to kind of like how many fish are what type are in what part of the sea and where are they moving and that kind of stuff?
Yeah. So it's a lot of data. And this goes back to what I forgot that you asked earlier, which is, you know, who cares and why does it matter? But I want to also add something else. So you said that we're up to about 20% of the ocean floor maps and a target to map it at, by 2030 to 100%. Yes, but that's at a very low resolution. That's at such a low resolution that if Manhattan were laying on the seafloor, we wouldn't know that it was there, right? So what TerraDepth is trying to do is map the ocean at a really high degree of resolution, down to about 8 centimeters. And some sensors won't be that sharp, but we're going to be at least 1 meter of accuracy of resolution or better. And you know, the meat and potatoes is what we're collecting is bathymetry, or you know, what the seafloor looks like. But that's not the only data that's important. So right now we have, you know, sonars on our prototype, but we have a really heavy power budget, so we can power a lot of different sensors at one time. So we want to collect water chemistry data. We want to collect biological data. We want to understand the environmental DNA. The entire idea is to create a holistic picture of what's going on in the ocean. So if we can have all those sensors collecting data and then have a smart enough robot that it can fuse that data, and then we can present it to humans in a way that's really intuitive and really sort of world-class in terms of software utility, there's so much value there. You think about just atmospheric data that, you know, exists on land and what, how valuable that is, right? Lots of different entities, organizations, companies, individuals consume that data for a number of reasons. So, you know, the kind of the early customers for subsea data have been governments and militaries and oil and gas. But as we start to bring the cost of that data down, it opens the door up to tons of other industries that want the data but haven't been able to afford it. So you think about the pharmaceutical industry, right? Drug discovery companies. 60% or 70% of all pharmaceuticals come from some natural resource, or they're synthesized from a natural resource. When you consider the fact that 98% of Earth's livable space is underwater, you can quickly see a future where the vast majority of all pharmaceuticals come from some natural resource that's in the ocean. So that's just one example. You think about insurance companies that are trying to do better at predicting weather patterns so that they can adjust their rates, you know, as a hurricane or a monsoon is coming together. Right now, they only have a part of the picture because they've got atmospheric data, but they don't have the subsea data. But both of those forces are critically important in determining what the weather is going to look like. And the list goes on and on.
Well, so maybe tell me a little bit about kind of how you're collecting the data. You know, obviously you're using autonomous hybrid vehicles, kind of robot submarines. You know, how many of them do you have to have in order to do kind of an effective job on kind of the whole ocean? And, you know, like how quickly can they process the data?
So a lot of the data processing is happening on the edge underwater in situ. So we've designed the robot to be able to identify objects on its own while it's underwater. There isn't time for it to go and, you know, collect data, then come up to the surface, send that data to humans. Humans then download the data, look at it for several hours and say, oh, wait a minute, look, there's a hydrothermal vent or there's a sunken ship or whatever, and then send it back to the robot, you know, days later, which is kind of how it's done today. So we put that processing on the edge so the robot can say, hey, I'm underwater at 6,000 meters. There's a hydrothermal vent. And I know that that's important because I've been programmed to know that that's important. So I'm going to spend some more time gathering more data around this area. So it might decide to make a few more passes around that object if it's a thermal vent or a sunken ship. It'll just collect more data, maybe turn on its video camera, infrared camera, some other sensors and collect more data. Maybe it hits a mountain and it says, wait a minute, the place I wanted to go to is no longer accessible. So I need to retask myself. I need a reroute plan. So we put that level of intelligence and decision-making on the robot. You know, our dream is to have several thousand of these things constantly collecting data all over the globe. I think if we had 8,000, we could do a pretty good job of kind of covering the globe at multiple depths sort of persistently. And that's what you want to get to, is where you have data over time, because that's when you can start to make decisions, because you can identify patterns that are recurring, right?
So it's the idea that to kind of persistently gather data and then sell that data to lots of different customers, or do you do specific projects for specific customers who want to know a specific thing?
Yeah, so it's a super expensive place to operate. So unfortunately, we can't afford to just go and collect all the data, populate some database, and then go to the world and say, hey, who wants to buy the data? Sure. So we've got kind of a phased market approach. So we'll start out by, you know, conducting survey work for companies like offshore wind or subsea telecom companies who are laying cables or doing inspections of infrastructure. And right now they're paying a lot of money for manned surface assets that may have some robotic capability or some AUVs on board. That's super expensive. So we'll come in with an option that's pretty competitive in that space. So the idea is that those hydrographic survey contracts will kind of subsidize our ability to slowly begin to build this fleet, so that over time we can get to a point where we can afford to collect data in advance of demand.
I guess one piece of the ocean-based blue economy that can sort of trip people up is the kind of the logistics and permitting involved, particularly with trying something new. You know, I guess it's complicated to figure out who has jurisdiction over which parts of the ocean and that kind of thing. How have you navigated that kind of process? You know, all these different countries with different claims to different parts of the ocean.
Fortunately, we're still so small and so young that we haven't gotten to that point yet. But obviously, we think about it a lot. We talk about it a lot. You know, permitting is a pain in the ass, no matter what you're looking at, pardon my French. So we're prepared for that. We've talked to a lot of operators. We've got some people on the team here who've been through that with other companies before. So we get it. And, you know, we have attorneys and staff to help us get through that. But you know, the important thing is that, first of all, half of the ocean is really ungoverned, right? It's not under anyone's jurisdiction. So half of it is sort of free range. The rest of it is owned economically by some country, some sovereign nation. And every sovereign nation is incentivized to understand what their coastal waters, their territorial waters look like. Because if there are resources there, whether it's oil or copper or sunken treasure, those resources belong to that country. So they want to know what's down there. So our idea is we'll go to that government and say, hey, look, you're not going to find a better option to survey your coastal waters. So let us do that for you. We'll give you a discounted rate, and in exchange, we share that data. And then TerraDepth can pass along that data, or maybe even like a subset of that data or a low resolution version of that data to consumers. And we'd like to be able to do that for free so that we can help educate people and help humans connect with the ocean.
Cool. In 2019, you announced that you raised $8 million in funding primarily through Seagate Technology. Tell me a little bit about kind of your partnership with Seagate, and how has that worked, and I guess where are you in kind of fundraising?
Yeah, so Seagate's a big public company, and their primary business is manufacturing data storage devices. So I think they manufacture about 60% of the world's hard drives. And so we partner with Seagate because what we're looking at doing is putting together one of the most comprehensive, most valuable data sets that's ever been compiled. And so Seagate would like for that data to rest back on their core competency data storage. But something that's a little more interesting is that, you know, Seagate is a pretty advanced robotics company, because a hard drive, even though we buy it for $30 on Amazon.com, has a very high level of engineering, you know, atomic level engineering inside each one of these devices. So it's super advanced. And you could argue that that's a type of robot in and of itself. There are components that move. It has to have some level of intelligence, and obviously the storage component. But also Seagate is building the robots that build those hard drives. And these are much more kind of traditional looking robots that have big articulating arms, and they're printing out, you know, lots of components every quarter. So when you think about Teradef's ultimate vision of sort of scaling the production of Teradef's robots, Seagate brings a lot to the table in terms of designing these things for scaled manufacturing. One of the big limitations in the industry now is that if you want to go purchase an AUV, an autonomous underwater vehicle, it's going to cost between $6 and $120 million, right? And $120 million is sort of just for Boeing's Echo Voyager. $6 to $10 is closer to like maybe the Hugin AUV or something. That's super expensive. You know, you're not going to get to where Teradef wants to be if your costs are that high. So we need to get down to a much more reasonable cost. And to do that, we've got to design it from the ground up with that scale manufacturing in mind. And so Seagate engineering team is helping with that. And then a third line is on the machine learning. So they have a team that's done some work on LiDAR, building databases of LiDAR images that are labeled. And that's the closest thing to sonar. And so when we started building our library of labeled sonar images, we were able to team up with some of Seagate's team who've done that in the past, and that was a big benefit. So there's a lot there. We're really happy to be partnered with Seagate.
Cool. Where are you kind of in terms of employees? You know, how many employees do you have? What are your kind of expansion plans for 21? What kind of talent are you looking for?
Yeah, so we have 12 full-time right now. Each person on the team is a total badass, so we're really lucky to have a lot of firepower in-house. This calendar year, we will roughly double that. So we're getting ready to raise another round of financing. And once we close that, we'll start hiring more people. And, you know, we need talent sort of in every area of the company. So you think about what Teradef is doing, it's a full stack company. We've got data solutions and interesting innovations on the data side, data fusion, data flows, data transfer, data management. So we need experts in those fields, machine learning, AI fields. You know, we've got a lot of work to do there, because, you know, even though we've kind of proven our ability for automatic target recognition, there's a lot more work to do, a lot more labeling to do, a lot more advancements to make in that realm. But also on the hardware side, you know, we want to continue to optimize the hardware so that we can bring the cost down, increase our duration. You know, right now we're probably at 15 days mission duration before we need to service it. We're trying to get to 45 days. So we need help. We need hardware engineers as well. And then the cloud front end side of things also. And on the hardware side, it's also software people that help make that hardware controllable autonomously. So we need software people to work in the hardware team. So it's really everything. We're excited to start recruiting again.
So maybe let's move a little bit to talk about kind of utility. You talked a little bit about this before, about kind of your initial customers. Give me the kind of wide range of different kinds of customers you might expect to have in the future, and kind of who could use this data. I mean, there are a lot of people who interact with the ocean, but I guess what's the, you know, who would be the core users, and I guess who could be some ancillary users?
Yeah. Core users we see as large companies that are, you know, building offshore wind farms, for example, maybe other offshore energy type facilities or infrastructure, the subsea telecom companies. You know, most people don't know, and this is kind of a wild stat, but 98% of all international communication that happens day to day on Earth goes through subsea cables, not through satellites. And that happens because the speed, the data rates on the cables is just still so much faster than satellite.
Are those all buried, or they're just kind of sitting on the ocean floor?
They're just resting on the ocean floor. I think some of them are buried, but generally they go out very, very deep so that they don't have to be buried. They can just rest on the sea floor. And then if something happens, they can find them more easily and make that repair. Insurance companies, you think about merchant shipping companies who are looking for the most efficient and safest route for their ships. You know, right now they're taking a guess and they're wrong about 40% of the time, and they'll send their, you know, $200 million ship and cargo right into a storm, not knowing it. And again, it's because they just don't have a holistic picture of what's happening. There's the salvage opportunity. You know, there's close to $5 billion worth of sunken treasure that we know about. These are just logged ships, you know, whether it's, you know, filled with Spanish gold from 400 years ago or something much more recent. There's a lot of value there. But also other, you know, rare earth minerals, other resources that are just resting on the seafloor. At the rate that humans are building smartphones, our need for these types of metals isn't going down, unfortunately. So those types of resources are in demand. And if you have the maps that identify where those things are, there's a lot of value there. But even down to, you know, individual fishermen, right? Of course, fisheries care, but individuals that may be out just recreationally fishing can open up their fishing app, and the fishing app will take data that comes from TerraDepth's systems, right? We're collecting chemical and biological data, and we'll be able to trace, you know, certain organisms and say, okay, well, based on this data, we can predict that there's going to be migration of these species of fish or whales or what have you. Surfer apps, right? A surfer is looking for, you know, the wave breaks, trying to find a secret spot. It opens up a surfing app, and guess what data is sort of feeding some of those algorithms? It's coming off of our systems. And there's the atmospheric data too. So NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Agency, that's the United States' version. Every major country has their version of that. They're hungry for the data. So there's kind of a long list, and it opens up more and more over time as the price of the data comes down.
So, you know, people really love space and kind of like the kind of thinking about kind of big, you know, big things on the Earth. Do you kind of anticipate it, like, as you can gather more data about what's in the ocean, do you think there, you know, you could get like armchair explorers and kind of, you know, more of a, I think it's sort of like Google Earth, like kind of, are there consumer uses for this kind of data or things that, you know, people could kind of interact with directly?
Yeah, we think so. We're planning on it. We certainly think the ocean is pretty awesome. We think space is awesome. But, you know, there are a lot of people who feel like the Earth is sort of over with in terms of places we can live on. And so they're turning their focus towards terraforming Mars or, you know, moving to the moon, which is interesting, and we should probably do that. But I think it makes a whole lot more sense to spend some time fixing Earth. And I could see a future world where, let's say, you know, Bill Gates is right, and in 30 years, if we don't change things, the Earth is no longer going to be sustainable by the human race. Would it make more sense to build infrastructure on Mars that we then fly to and then live inside that? Or could we build, you know, infrastructure underwater on Earth, and then we sort of move into these subsea buildings and have sort of underwater cities? I think that makes a lot more sense if we're talking that extreme. So there's that component of it, but also it's cool to explore places. You know, we're all natural born explorers, but unless you're a billionaire, you're not going to be exploring Mariana's Trench or looking at the Titanic, unless you put on your VR headset and use TerraDepth's data and go swim or dive through some part of the ocean, which we expect to have that rendered in a way that's really beautiful and pulls you in, so that, you know, you don't have to be a professional hydrographer to care. You could be a 10-year-old who just is curious, and you can have a really exciting time virtually exploring the ocean. Just like I remember the first time I sat down on Google Earth, you know, in the early 2000s, and I was there for hours. It was like a video game, just exploring. It was so much fun. And so we're going to try to replicate that type of experience, but with the ocean.
Have you gotten any kind of, unusual requests for people, like as billionaires who have like ideas of what they want to do with the data or whatever? You know, I think of like, you know, these people who do seasteading or trying to create like, you know, alternative communities. I guess, have you had any weird, weird requests for this kind of stuff?
So we've been talking to Fabien Cousteau, who is Jacques Cousteau's great grandson or grandnephew, I can't remember, but interesting guy and obviously passionate about the ocean. And he is trying to build the International Space Station of the sea. And so he reached out to us and he said, you know, we're going to need to A, survey the area before we go underwater and build this thing. And it's this massive, beautiful, futuristic facility that'll be, you know, a beacon for ocean education, scientific research, and ocean exploration. So that's kind of been exciting to maintain that conversation with his team. We hope that we can move forward, hope that he moves forward there with that. The chairman of Terranet's board is this really fascinating, great guy. His name is Steve Lusso. And Steve has been on the board at Microsoft and AT&T, and he's just one of these global thinkers. And when we pitched him on the idea years ago, his first reaction was, this is awesome. You're going to find the cure for cancer. And that's one of his life passions, is helping to facilitate the discovery of some cure for cancer. And he could be right. You know, there's that right now, two of the leading drugs for, I think it's Hodgkin's leukemia, come from a resource found in the ocean.
Wow. Cool. Well, I guess that's pretty much all I have for the kind of the questions that I had. But did you have anything else you wanted to talk about or anything else maybe I missed?
I don't think so. I mean, I could talk for hours. We could go around and around, but,
no, I mean, it's super fascinating. One other question I have is, I guess, you know, with the exception of all this stuff that you're working on personally, you know, I guess what other exciting things do you see happening in blue tech and kind of the blue economy? And, you know, how do you hope to?
Yeah. So, you know, blue tech, I think generally, the blue economy and blue tech, it's sort of just the ocean. We're seeing more attention on the ocean than we've seen in decades. And I've been becoming friends with a lot more people who've been around kind of the industry, the ocean industry, longer than I have. And they have the same observations. Over the last 3 or 4 years, the ocean has started to really have this moment, which is super exciting. So I think there's a lot of, you know, a lot of energy going into blue tech, I think specifically around autonomous systems. You know, you look at autonomous shipping companies, we're doing our thing. But I think what's probably the most compelling outside of what we're doing is the seaweed revolution and what can happen with seaweed. I recently read the Seaweed Manifesto, which I would encourage anyone to read. It's not too long. But seaweed is a remarkable natural resource, and it can help the Earth and our race considerably. So I think we need to start spending more time, you know, reading about, learning about seaweed, what it can do for us. You know, there are food products, you know, carbon sequestration, the list goes on and on and on. It's an energy source. So I'm excited about what will happen in terms of seaweed growth over the next few years. But generally speaking, I just think that there's a bunch of awesome stuff happening and the ocean is cool. And I think we'll see really more non-ocean industry people or non-ocean experts paying more attention to it in the same way that we've seen space get more attention from the regular folks.
Cool. Well, thanks so much for joining us. It was really wonderful.
Yeah, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Blue Economy Podcast, presented by Rhode Island, the Ocean State. And thanks again to Judson Kaufman of TerraDepth for joining us. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you'd like to learn more about us, catch up on past episodes, or shoot us a note with your comments, head to our website at www.blueeconomypodcast.com or look us up on Twitter, Facebook, or LinkedIn. From beautiful Providence, Rhode Island, the greatest small city in the world, I'm your host, David Hirschman. Thanks for listening.